we filed an amicus brief in support of the city's legal position, and we're with you on that. I also want to thank you for working with the congressional delegation to protect the federal lands in the Bull Run. As you know, the Bush administration has struck a sweetheart deal with the logging industry, and we could see logging levels of old growth go up 700% as a result of these deals. Thank goodness the Bull Run is not at risk for that right now. Many other municipalities are facing increased logging in their municipal drinking watersheds. As in any negotiation between the Forest Service, the city, and conservationists, the negotiations on this document were complex. And we thank the agencies for several improvements made to the documents. But we still have some difficulty. it's a complex document. And I just want to bring up two items that make us difficult to support the memorandum. The first is the agreement that the city take over maintenance of the road structure on federal lands. And I know why that's been done. I know the federal government under the Bush administration is spending, you know, gazillions of dollars fighting an illegal war, and we don't have any money for road maintenance on our public lands or for trail maintenance for that matter. But I would hope that that would change in the future, and that's one of the reasons that we hope that in the future that there'll be a change in administration, there'll be a change in values and the way public monies are spent, and we can have the federal government pay for what's federal road system in the Bull Run. The second reason, and probably the most problematic, is that the grand vision for the land exchange is problematic. While the rationale is for increased efficiencies for the agencies, the activities that could be more efficiently implemented may not always be consistent with the public interest. In fact, we asked that the agreement not, we stated that the agreement did not provide sufficient details regarding if and how federal land acquired by the city through the exchange would be protected. The public loses important legal tools to protect our land, air, and water and wildlife on federal lands when the city acquires the lands. We lose the protection of the National Forest Management Act, Northwest Forest Plan, and some of the other things that Gary showed you on the screen there. However, we have decided that we are not going to oppose the memorandum. As a practical matter, we're going to work with the, it makes more sense to work with the Commissioner's Office and the Bureau to implement city ordinances and resolutions that will provide some structure and certainty for future generations. Certainly this city council has been grand at protecting the Bull Run, but it's an intent and current practice rather than anything that's written into city ordinance. And we look forward to working with you to not only ensure that there's no tree cutting on city lands, but also that there's a dispute resolution process that does not exist now. And our primary concern is that we protect the lands that are now Forest Service lands and have those federal protections from settlement, recreation, and development. So you understand how this is a complex situation. We'd rather not have had the land exchange included in this document at all, but work through some of the functional plans and other processes. And we will be doing that both on the federal level and with the city.
And just so I'm clear about that on the record, we've met with REGNA and other interested advocates of the Bull Run, and we've agreed to create a process by which we would sit down and have all these discussions. And because I certainly would be interested in making sure that future councils don't have the authority to do something they can't do now because it's federal land. So we're going to work through all those issues.
And I would hope that, you know, some of you may or may not be on future councils. I might not be around in the future, but that the framework that we provide will provide those permanent protections.
Absolutely.
That we now have on federal land. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Cascade Anderson-Geller. I just want to ditto some of the things that REGNA Merritt has shared with you, but I wanted to speak to something that I think is important that I don't see in this document that is easy to change, I believe. And that is that it needs to be consistent with public law the Bull Run Act public law 95-200. I haven't had the opportunity to study it as much as I would like to, but what jumped out at me right away was the difference in the language between Public Law 200, the Bull Run Act, which uses the language, the Secretary shall prohibit the cutting of trees. And the way it looks like it's called out in this new memorandum of agreement is calling timbering tree harvest or timber harvest. And I think that there is a difference there. And because of the shifting, always shifting sands of policy and politics and the inconsistencies, I think we could really help this document by making it very consistent with the Bull Run Act language that's stood by us for all this time. And I think that you've heard, I know that a lot of you have heard, as we've heard, this has gone through different commissioners. If we follow the Bull Run back to the 1890s when it was established, people have consistently said protect, protect, protect. And permanent protection is very important. So I think that this document that we're looking at could be aided by using the language right directly out of the Bull Run Act whenever possible. So I think that's my main... actually, I was curious about the experiments or scientific investigations that are called for in this new understanding. It isn't clear in there exactly what we're talking about. I would just like to emphasize that I don't think that anything that's done up there should jeopardize water quality, and I think that we would all agree with that, but it is a little bit unclear in the document. So thank you. Maybe this will come forward in a second reading, maybe.
Okay, thank you very much.
As I said, we're committed to setting up another process where you're more than welcome to participate, okay, where we address all those issues.
Right. All right, thank you, and thank you very much for the opportunity.
Has the land sale, well, not the land sale, the land exchange come back to the council for approval?
Eddie?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear your question, Mayor.
Does the land exchange come back to council for approval?
Absolutely. So, yeah, there won't be any initiation of the land exchange until council authorizes it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah, and I want to thank, too, Eddie, who headed this up under my office, but certainly those that came before Eddie that worked on it, City Attorney's Office, Ty Kovach played a key role in the final few negotiating sessions to move this forward. So it was great work on everybody's part. Thank you. Very tough to do.
It's non-emergency and moves to a second reading. What is the date and time for that, Carla?
That'll be on next week's agenda, October 10th agenda on the 9:30 regular session.
Okay. Thank you. Please read the 10 a.m. time certain.
Item 1167, accept the Portland Urban Canopy Assessment and Public Tree Evaluation.
Mr. Saltzman.
Thank you, Mayor, and members of the council. The presentation of the information about our tree canopy, I think, follows well on the report we just had on Bull Run. And I'm proud to present this important work by the Urban Forestry Department in Portland Parks and Recreation. Trees are a crucial part of the cityscape. They soften and beautify the built environment, and they provide multiple environmental benefits, from stormwater management to providing shade, cooling down the urban environment, to providing a source of absorbing carbon dioxide and putting out oxygen instead. So trees are an important part of our infrastructure, and that's something we'll probably talk a little bit more about in this report. And these days, I think everybody's concerned about trees in the city. Last March, the council accepted the Urban Forest Action Plan, a collective roadmap developed by a number of bureaus to ensure attainment of the goals and recommendations of the Urban Forestry Management Plan of 2004. As a step toward meeting the actions outlined in the management plan, Parks City Nature staff conducted a study of the benefits provided by Portland's urban forest canopy. The study helped calculate the value of the environment and aesthetic benefits that these trees provide, and partial funding of this came from a grant provided provided by the Endangered Species Act program. So we have with us this morning David McAllister, city forester, and Jennifer Karps, who authored the study, and to present their findings.
Mayor Potter, members of the council, my name is Dave McAllister, and I am the city nature manager, Parks and Recreation, and I'm also the city forester for the city. With me today is Jennifer Karps, also the city nature and the person responsible, as Commissioner Saltzman said, for actually doing the work of this study. Today we want to present you with the results of the study completed during the summer of 2006 by the Urban Forestry Division of City Nature. The study provides an assessment of the structure and function of the city's public trees. It focuses on our public trees, defined here as trees in the right-of-way, within our developed parks, and in our natural areas. The study results are statistically valid estimates based on a suite of methods developed by the U.S. Forest Service Center for Urban Forest Research. And the study becomes part of overall parks asset inventory. Through this study, we've been able to define not only the key attributes of our forest structure, but also quantify a number of environmental and other benefits arising from this publicly owned asset. Finally, with the Sleitler-Corser evaluation technique, we have also determined a number of environmental benefits accruing from the entire urban forest, both private and public parcels. So this first slide shows you that we have overall canopy cover for the entire city of approximately 26%. Of that 26%, 47% of that is located on public ownership, and 53% is represented on public lands. Our success in managing the urban forest has to be a true partnership between both government and the public. Now, this study that we are presenting today evaluated several aspects of the forest. Forest structure, that is, species composition, diversity, age distribution, and condition. Resource function, that is, the magnitude of the environmental and aesthetic benefits. Resource value, the dollar values of the benefits that are realized. And we also identified the forest management needs. With regard to street trees, now we estimate there are 236,000 street trees within Portland, representing approximately 171 different types. The five most common trees within our street tree population are Norway maple, red maple, big leaf maple, arborvitae, and cherry. Of those, only big leaf maple is considered a native, and that is understandable given the harsher conditions of our right-of-way areas. With regard to park trees, our parks and natural areas contain approximately 1.2 million trees. In contrast to street tree population, there are fewer different types of trees present, with only 41 different types represented. Again, in contrast to street trees, there is a much higher percentage of native trees, with the most prevalent red alder, vine maple, Douglas fir, black cottonwood, and big leaf maple, all native. These five species constitute approximately 66% of the entire species number. So, taken together, the study shows that we really do have a large range of diversity for Portlanders to enjoy, taking both in consideration our street trees and our park trees. The graph in front of you also shows that our forest is a multi-age population structure, and it suggests that this is a good forest that is conducive to management. The chart indicates that there are many more small-sized than larger trees. The older trees provide the highest current benefit to the citizens. The smaller trees provide future potential benefits. So, We went on to look at the assessment of our tree condition, and our assessment looked at this in terms of a relative health, and we've seen by the study results that our park trees are in better health than our street trees, and this is understandable since the current conditions for street trees are inherently more difficult. I might add that while this is the study results, we used a slightly different criteria in our Portland arborist here in the city are more tuned to these things, and they have said on their site-specific evaluations that the study results may slightly overestimate the health of the forest, and certainly want to point that out. With regard to our street tree stocking levels, the citywide we have 45% of the street tree planting opportunities currently occupied. So the glass is half full, roughly speaking. And southeast and northeast Portland indicate the greatest opportunity for new plantings to benefit this citywide total. There are fewer opportunities in the western part of the city, but they seem to have a higher occupancy. In other words, the greater portion of the total opportunity is already planted. Now, using the Council of Tree and Landscape Appraiser Evaluation Criteria, this study determined an overall value for street and park trees of $2.3 billion. Adding private trees to this amount suggests an aggregate value for the entire forest of approximately $5 billion. And I might add that $2.3 billion is a huge number. In our current accounting system, city's accounting system, this is not considered a capital asset, so it's not documented as having that value. By analyzing the structure of the city trees and applying values to the functions the city trees provide, we were able to quantify a range of environmental and aesthetic benefits from our urban forest. Annual carbon fixed by the forest is 25 million pounds with a benefit value of $207,000. Stored carbon within our public forests offsets contributions by the city through residential and industrial sources, thus reducing its net increase in greenhouse gas emissions. The forest's cooling effect in the summer and sheltering effect in the winter reduces natural gas and electricity use of 200,000 therms and 6,000 megawatt hours, respectively, with an annual cost saving of $751,000 to city residents. Stormwater uptake of 414 million gallons by the root structures of public trees saves the city and ratepayer over $11.5 million in annual costs. This is an average of $20.67 per city resident. Finally, increases in property values from street tree planting alone totals $14 million. And collectively, all these numbers that I'm giving you here approximate $27 million in annual benefits to the city, or $49 per resident. The study also assembled a cost, that is, those costs to maintain our urban forest, and this slide documents that fact. We have an aggregated cost, conservatively, of around $6.5 million to manage this forest that we have. Comparing the management costs and the benefits together, study results indicate that the public forest is a valuable asset to the city with a cost-benefit ratio of 3.8 to 1. In other words, $1 invested by the city and provides $3.80 in benefits back. We also had an opportunity to use a somewhat coarser method, and through that method, we were able to look at the environmental benefits from the entire urban forest, both private and public. Both public and private trees sequester 53 million pounds of carbon from the atmosphere, 2 million pounds of air pollutants, and 1.3 million gallons of stormwater. This represents a collective environmental benefit to city residents of $70 per capita. So as Commissioner Saltzman mentioned, you know, we have this urban forest management plan. The city is currently at 26%. The management plan calls for a target level of 33%. Commissioner Saltzman mentioned that we are using the urban forest action plan that was passed in March to actually move toward meeting those goals. What that means for the city, it will continue to reduce the city's hard infrastructure costs, such as pollution control devices and stormwater pipes. You know, this is the green infrastructure now, not the gray infrastructure. It'll increase the environmental, aesthetic, and wildlife benefits that result from additional tree canopy in the city. And it will continue to help meet the city's sustainability goals and contribute to the city's reputation for a high quality of life. Now, we have management recommendations. Basically, it's take care of your existing environment and plan for the future. But to maintain and enhance our urban forest and maximizing those benefits and minimizing the safety hazards that can occur, we recognize this is a working forest. But we do need to increase our existing tree maintenance. We do proper pruning of our older trees, which are the trees that are accruing most of this benefit for the citizens. And we need to enhance the survival of younger trees so that they can become older and continue to contribute this increased benefit. And through that, I mean that we need to complete a better tree inventory, because that will help us focus on the needs of the forest in the most cost-effective and judicious manner. We need to increase our tree planting, and that both includes creating opportunities in development and redevelopment, and partnering up with our community groups throughout the city to do tree planting, which we have done in the past, and I think there's equity questions out there. We need to get back into some of these neighborhoods, and you can see that in both Southeast and outer East Portland, and there is a great deal of opportunity there and tree planting opportunities. So, and finally, I might say that there is in terms of this partnership, I mean, half of the forest is private property, and we need to increase our public education and outreach efforts to that other part of the urban forest. And through that, we need to provide technical assistance to these property owners, provide them the information they need to do a better job of maintaining their trees in the ways that we can. So that's just a brief overview of the report. It concludes our report here, and if you have any questions, I appreciate the opportunity to answer them.
Dave, what happens to I noticed that like 1% of the trees are dead or dying. What do you do with those trees? Do you take them out or leave them there, or what do you do?
Absolutely. You know, Mayor Potter, what we do here, this is a little different. We're not the Forest Service. You know, we don't get our product out of the forest. It's not a product. The forest provides a service by standing, but as soon as those trees are become unhealthy, they become safety hazards for the public. And so we do get them out of there, and we have repositories. We place them. We've also worked with the ESA program to put those trees back in the streams so that we can create the complex habitat for fish. But we're trying to get rid of those trees. Now, in natural areas, if that 1% that we're talking about or thereabouts, I mean, that's wildlife habitat. So we aren't going to be looking in a natural area, in Forest Park perhaps, for looking at that 1% and saying, gee, we should get rid of it. No, we probably wanted to keep it there because it's going to provide homes for pileated woodpeckers and other things like that.
Thank you.
So one of the things we were talking about yesterday in preparation for this report is the fact that, you know, our park tree infrastructure is a $2.3 billion asset, and yet it's not reflected really in the city's official government reporting plans, which are increasingly requiring city to quantify all their assets. So it's not treated as a capital asset. And I guess that's something, I see Ken Rust is here. I guess I'd like to explore because I think there's a certain benefit if we do start reporting this as a capital asset. I understand that that would allow us to seek metro natural area funding to do tree plantings, among other things, but I also think it's important just because we all appreciate the growing importance of this capital asset. So, Ken, do you want to just come up and tell us whether this is something we can start doing, treating our trees as a capital asset, our park trees and street trees?
Yeah. Good morning, council members. Ken Russ with the Office of Management and Finance. And I think it is an interesting question about how we capitalize these important assets. And as I understand it in talking with the city controller, is it's a little bit more of a complicated question. Depending on the value of the improvement that we're making, we do actually capitalize the asset associated with trees. We have a capitalization threshold of $10,000 in the city. So you could imagine that if we planted a single tree or maybe just a small group of trees, that threshold would not be met, and we would otherwise treat that as an operating expense. And for accounting purposes, it would not be reflected as an asset on our books and records. When we do a larger improvement that's part of maybe a park improvement where we're adding landscaping and trees as part of that, then it does become something that is shown on our books and records as a capital asset subject to depreciation, which also brings up an interesting, you know, question as well, is that unlike most assets, trees and these kinds of investments may actually increase in value, not decrease in value. So the accounting world isn't well equipped to deal with the way these particular assets may perform, and does bring up some interesting questions about how we would maybe look at valuing that, or at least being recognizing that the asset information of the city maybe needs to have some additional information shown around it that to reflect and pick up on some of the unique characteristics of things that aren't really really well captured by the financial measurement that we do on a given year. But it is a little bit more of a mix in terms of the way we look at them on our records.
So, yeah, I guess this is something I would like to explore further. I mean, it sounds kind of dry and mundane, but I think it could have potential benefits to us, I think, as a city, and maybe other cities will shortly follow our lead, but, you know, to look at our urban canopy and really value it as a capital asset, but also it would also entitle us to apply for Metro Natural Areas funds for tree planting.
So, well, certainly, as you know, the whole idea of the greening of our practices moves forward, you know, the accounting profession and the governmental accounting standard boards that sets rules and regulations for the way in which we conduct our financial operations may very well want to look at that, because clearly, you know, there's a mismatch between the way we're expending funds and the values we're creating as a result of that. They are very concerned when we're doing things that understate the liabilities that we are incurring. At the same time, if we're understating the assets that are resulting from that, they should take a look at that as well. So, you know, it could be a very provocative kind of discussion with that group as well.
Well, I definitely want to continue that discussion with you and our forester and maybe come back for some council action on that.
Thank you.
Jennifer, did you have anything you wanted to add?
I'm just here to provide technical advice if I'm asked. So, no, thank you.
So that completes testimony. I guess we have, I know we have at least one member of our Urban Forestry Commission, maybe several here. Are you all signed up to testify?
Can we call the list?
Yeah. Why don't you just call the list?
Could you? How many folks are signed up?
I have just two, Brian Craig and Linda Robinson.
Okay.
Cascade Anderson Geller.
Thanks for being here, folks. When you speak, please state your name for the record. You each have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Commissioner, Mayor Potter, Commissioners. My name is Brian Krieg, and I am a member of the Urban Forestry Commission. Also in the audience today, we have Christine Karnazes and Margot Barnett behind me here. I also, on the commission, I serve as the chair of the Education and Outreach Committee that we have. On behalf of the commission, I'd like to let you know how excited we are about this report. It's a major achievement for the city. The quantification of what the value of our trees are, the numbers and the data will allow us to do a very good job in the future for strategic decisions, both the commission, the staff, and providing you with the information you need to make the decisions about Portland's future of its urban forest. Other cities are looking at their urban forests also. I think one of the key things, the two software packages that were used with this were developed by other entities. And so the issue of the valuation and the importance of the urban forest to our livability is something that other cities and communities are looking at also. We are lucky in Portland that we have a very good situation with our tree canopy to begin with. Past city strategies and visions have really resulted in this mature tree canopy that we have, and that we have very good coverage. And as was noted, the mature trees really provide us the higher amount of the benefits to the community. And while it's important for us to continue to plant new trees and look for areas strategically to do so, I think the commission members would all echo this point, that it's vital for us to maintain the large trees that we have in the community, and that policies from the city should try to do so on that. Also, as we begin to plant more trees in the city, we have a very active ongoing programs, both the city itself, but then organizations out there like Friends of Trees who support those activities on the private properties. I think it's really important now that we have more of this data in front of us to start looking at it from a strategic standpoint of how and where we're actually going to be planting the trees. Recent studies about air quality and benzene levels and other things, if you start looking at that and doing a little bit of overlay of that, you look at water quality issues, you start to see corridors in the city where the increased planting of trees and the maintenance of those that we have becomes even more vitally important. Many of our schools, and when we were looking at some of those air quality studies, many of our schools were located in those corridors that had very high air quality issues with it. And I know that the urban forestry staff now is looking at increasing the number of tree plantings that we're going to be doing at schools across the city. But that's the type of thing that this report will help us with, is developing actual strategies on that. The action plan that you approved back in March, it provides us with a very good roadmap. It's something that the commission worked with staff on, that there's a great deal of information on. And the importance of it is how effectively we implement it, and that's something that the commission sees as a vital role for it in the way of outreach, education, and other activities on it. I'd like to close by just making one comment that the public trees in this city work for us 24/7, 365 days a year. I would like to nominate them as the hardest working employees the city has.
My name is Linda Robinson, and I live in Outer East Portland. And there's only one thing I wanted to make a comment on. I agree with the basic recommendations that come out of the report, that we need to plant more trees, we need to maintain the ones we have, we need to do public outreach and education. But there's one more thing that we need to do that I didn't see on there, and that's to protect our trees through, in part, the review that was partially funded this last year to review the tree codes and also to enforce the tree codes. This is a really important part. I know that you did authorize some funding to start that project. It was to be a two-year project, so we need to fund that. We need to get it started, and then we need to fund that second year. So I just wanted to add that as another important part of this.
Cascade Anderson Geller. It's great to see this informational presentation, and I just had a couple of things I wanted to speak to. First of all, we've had a major change in the way we do tree production in the city, and I've had the opportunity to live for more than 25 years by our nursery by Mount Tabor Park, at Mount Tabor Park, that grows out trees to larger caliper for planting out in our parks and public spaces. This is a very important piece of Portland's history of growing trees and creating street trees. A lot of communities didn't like to do street trees because it put the burden of maintenance on the city. If people wanted trees, by God, they should plant them themselves. That was pretty much the way that it was. Portland did step forward with some good leadership through the Olmsted, the person who worked for Olmsted for so many years and then came as our park superintendent and said, we will have street trees in Portland. And he planted 32,000 of them, saplings out at the Portland Nursery, where they grew to be a lot of the forest canopy that we get to have the benefit of today. So recently we have made the decision in the Parks Bureau to stop growing out trees to large caliber and to stop using that land at Mount Tabor Park to grow trees to larger caliber. So now no more new trees are being planted in there. They're digging them out, and that land is going to be open up to discussions in the Mount Tabor master plan update that we were all talking about last week. I'm very concerned about the lack of the attention to this issue about growing to larger caliber. One reason is because larger caliber trees provide more beauty. They grow by being protected in nursery instead of setting out very small trees. We have a nicer look, but maybe more importantly, our trees are, especially urban trees, are very prone to vandalism. And I have, you know, numerous pictures I've taken over the years for different presentations I do of many vandalized trees. And small trees are very easy for someone who is not very smart or not very nice to damage. So I think that this issue needs to be looked at by the council in greater detail. And we will be bringing it up again to you. The other thing is about consistency in policy, and maybe that's the word I was talking about last on the last issue about the language. But I think the city needs to follow its own policies and rules in permitting with the trees. I've had instances where I know the city was not consistent with its own permitting policy and the trees on public lands being cut. And I think that this is something we should set the precedent of following our own code. Thank you very much.
Thank you, folks. Any other testimony?
That's all who signed up.
Okay. This report, I need a motion to accept and a second.
So moved.
Second.
Please call the vote.
Adams?
A really important step forward. Excellent work. Thanks for all your efforts. Thanks to Commissioner Saltzman for his leadership. Aye.
Leonard?
And I totally agree. It's a great product. Thank you. Aye.
Saltzman?
Well, I want to thank the Urban Forestry Commission, the Portland Parks and Recreation folks who worked on this. It is a great report. I think it is a starting point of appreciating an important part of our infrastructure. I just want to add with respect to the tree code, the money we approved last year to start revamping and making our tree code more holistic. Even though it is a two-year process, I have asked Gil Kelly, our Planning Bureau Director, to focus on the enforcement part and try to deliver that in 1 year. So that's something I'm keeping my eye on closely. Aye.
Sten.
I agree. Thanks to all of you and great work. Aye.
Potter.
I want to thank the Urban Forestry Commission. Citizens are the backbone of our community and are the strength, I think the real strength of Portland. So you folks exemplify that. I really want to thank you and also the staff of the Parks Bureau. Just are incredible folks that do a great job, and I think this report reflects that. Aye. Please read the 10:15 time certain.
Item 1168, appoint 4 Citizen Campaign Commission members.
Auditor Blackmer.
Good morning, Mayor, members of Council. Before you is a resolution to fill vacancies that are coming due on the 7-member Citizen Campaign Commission. We went through a written application process. Notifications went out through ONI and other organizations to recruit members, and we got a really good, talented group of people. We went through an interview process and selected 4 of the applicants, and 3 of them can be here this morning, so I wanted to introduce them and so you can see them. So I'll sit down in a moment. The 3 that can attend are Dylan Amo, Peter Forsyth, and Casey Jama. In addition, Catherine McLaughlin is up for appointment. And of the first 3 have a 4-year term, and Catherine will be filling out a vacant term that is due to expire in about 2 years. So let me introduce them, and you can see them face-to-face.
Did you say that Catherine's filling a short term?
Yes, she requested
that.
Different
than what it said in the resolution.
We have 3 that have a term that expires on October 3, 2011,
yes.
And Catherine's term expires in 2009.
So, but you see here it shows Peter Forsyth is the one that's expiring in 2009. Did you wish to...
Yeah, I would like to amend that because that was our preliminary draft, and they had we discussed it with them, and they chose Catherine preferred the 2-year term.
Would you like to have this amended? Is there, could we get a, amendment to this? Does anybody wish to make a motion?
I would move the amendment as the auditor stated it.
Okay.
Second.
Call a vote.
Would you like to see them?
There. Yeah, we'll just this is just the amendment on the.
Adams?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Sten?
Pete, you've got us here 4 years. Aye.
Potter?
Aye.
Let me introduce that then.
Yes. Thank you for being here, folks. When you speak, please state your name for the record and just tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'll begin. My name is Dylan Amo. I am very excited to be here, excited to serve on this commission. As I was talking to the auditor this morning, I have a great passion for politics, a great passion for campaigning. I live six blocks from City Hall, and I've never been involved in local politics, and I see this as a great opportunity for me to work with the current commissioners and the people you have before you to do some great stuff.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mayor Tom and commissioners. My name is Casey Chama. I am really, really thrilled to be here today and to be part of this commission. I really honor to serve because I greatly believe that creating a process where there's accountability, but also there's a place that citizens and folks who are interested in public service can have a playing field, equal playing field to participate. I think this is really important, and that's one of the things that I like in Portland. And so I'm really honored to be in front of you today, and I'm really happy to work with you in the near future. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Pete Forsyth. I've been following the public financing system in the news for some time, and I think it has a great deal of potential. I think, as we saw in the last election cycle, there's also a great deal of danger as well if it's not implemented and overseen carefully. So I think it's important to make sure that the statute is well written and that it's overseen with diligence, and I hope that I can contribute to that.
Thank you. Is there anybody signed up to testify on this matter?
No one signed up.
Okay, this is a resolution. Please call the vote.
Adams?
Well, congratulations. Good luck.
Aye. Leonard?
Well, and if you're wondering maybe how to approach your job, given that it's brand new, interestingly, I think that the person that demonstrated best how maybe to approach your job wasn't from the commission, but a reporter for the Oregonian, Anna Griffin. So you might follow some of her techniques in applying those skills she demonstrated in the last election to this one. And I think that if we're all vigilant, I do believe this will be a very successful program. And but it does require vigilance on all of our part to make sure the rules are followed and everybody is living up to them. And that's a big responsibility for each of you, especially in this next couple of years. So appreciate your willingness to serve. Aye.
Saltzman.
Well, congratulations, and I do appreciate your willingness to serve, too. Aye.
Sten.
Well, these are terrific nominees. I do know two of them well, and I'm really glad you're willing to serve. This is really important right now. I think I'm passionate about this. As you know, our country is desperately in need of election reform, and I think as the last cycle showed, you know, there are problems at every level. When you mix money in politics, you get bad policy, but you also don't get the kind of elections we want. And I think voter-owned elections are really the future if we want to restore faith in government. And I think I still, hopefully I won't be after next May, but I believe I'm the only local elected official in the country elected using voter-owned elections and have run in both systems. And I think that it's dramatically better to run as a voter-owned candidate. And I think that you guys helping us make the system better, make it work. And I think that this system is optimistic, progressive. It gives a chance for a lot of talent that would not be able to raise the kind of money it takes, mainly from real estate, which is who funds city races. To run is a big deal, and I think that. But at the same time, it's something that's got to be made work, and I think that's going to be your job. And I'm really glad you're stepping up to do it. So, aye.
Potter.
I really appreciate you folks stepping forward. This is an important program because For me, it's about making sure that the playing field is level for everyone, and this is a really important tool to do that. And so with your oversight, I think we're going to have a good campaign season, and for folks who are interested, I heartily recommend that citizens who are thinking about running apply for this, because it is one way that you can obtain funding and do it in a manner that's consistent with how Portland works. So thank you. All right. Go to the regular agenda. Please read item 1187. What happened? What did you?
You want to do that first?
No. It can wait. Yeah. Regular. I just had to talk to you about a different agenda.
1187.
Resolve to increase community problem solving and Project 57 funding to appropriately address chronic offenders for drug and prostitution crimes.
Commissioner Leonard and I are co-sponsoring this resolution that will sunset the drug and prostitution-free zones and focus on efforts of addressing the root causes of these problems. The zones expired on September 30th, and we really need to discuss the next steps. To assist in this effort, we're calling for expanding funding for the P57, that is the 57 jail beds that we rent, and the Voluntary Substance Abuse Treatment Program as a tool for the police and the community as they work together using problem-solving techniques and community policing principles to solve these community problems. I've asked the Police Bureau to begin the discussion on how the expansion might work logistically, and I'd like them to come up and brief us on how the program is working to date and brief us on their meeting yesterday. Assistant Chief Lene Berg is taking the lead on the project. Commissioner Leonard, did you want to make an opening statement?
If you don't mind, I would. I don't have prepared remarks, but I do want to kind of give my perspective on this issue, because it is something that's been of some discussion in the community since the expiration date of the DFCs and the prostitution-free zones have been approaching. And I wanted to give my perspective. The mayor's done really great work in having John Campbell do the analysis that John did and determine some of the things that John did. But I will tell you that I opposed the zones before that. I actually think the analysis that the mayor did doesn't set the bar so high that we couldn't address those issues and fix them. I also think that the constitutional issues that others have articulated can't be addressed as well. But I still oppose the zones. And I think it's important for me to say why. Nobody has yet been able to convince me or the rest of the council that, for an example, if you have a prostitute that's working between 102nd and Sandy, 122nd Sandy, and you prohibit her from being in that zone, that she quits being a prostitute. I mean, she may quit being a prostitute in that zone and make the businesses and the neighbors in Park Rose happy, and I know that they are. But then the folks on 15th and Sandy aren't real happy when she decides to set up shop there, or 135th and Sandy when she starts working there, or 3rd and Cooch in Jeff's backyard, or on 82nd Favelle, where I see a lot of prostitutes. So for me, that's the core issue, is that we're not solving the issue. We're moving it to other people's neighborhoods. And each of us here represent everybody in Portland. So that we have some people that like drug-free zones and others that are upset because all of a sudden there's criminal activity in front of their house remains a problem for me. What I have been just so thrilled with is the effectiveness of Project 57 and the impact that it apparently has in really getting to the core root of the criminal activity that we see, whether it's drug dealing, drug use, or prostitution, or Johns, or whatever. I am just of the firm belief, based on a number of years in public life, serving in the legislature on the Ways and Means Committee, passing budgets for the state prisons, that treatment programs work. And I've sat through hours and hours of testimony from the most hardened criminals. I shouldn't say that you can imagine. You probably are the ones that arrested them originally. But that at least I could imagine, and my colleagues in the legislature were just stunned at these what otherwise would be frightening people who once were able to get into recovery and treatment, turn their lives around, and not only quit offending and committing crimes, we're helping other people that were in those life cycles get them to the place they were. And I just believe that I just couldn't be more thrilled that today this is the discussion, because that's what we're talking about, is actually doing proactive things to not just reduce crime that really impacts neighborhoods, but to change people's lives that are stuck, that are addicted to drugs or alcoholism, or for maybe even have a layer of mental issues on top, and most of them do. So I just want to just say publicly, Mayor, how pleased I am with this approach. And it's for me a hallmark of my service to be able to actually have us all focus, and the resources as well, to focus on this kind of problem solving that really changes people's lives. And I make no secret, I work with Jeff Myers all the time, and that Jeff's involved and helping on this just gives me just all kinds of hope that we're really turning a corner in Portland and how we address these issues. Make the job easier for police officers, make the community safer for other folks. And we quit getting nasty emails from people about, you know, cleaning up a crime. I mean, because we're actually being effective. So thank you very much.
Chief.
Thank you, Mayor, Commissioner Sten, and Commissioner Leonard, for an opportunity to talk to you today about the successes of the VSAT P57 and ideas that we have about expanding that program to address key livability issues and the need for treatment in the community. My name is Lene Berg, and I am an assistant chief with the City of Portland. We met yesterday in a small group with Maria Rubio from the mayor's office, Heather Lyons from BHCD, Ed Blackburn, who's here today from Central City Concerns, Kathleen Treb from Multnomah County. She is here today as well, along with Officer Jeff Myers and Commander Mike Reese. And the purpose of the meeting was to begin planning for expansion of the P57 VSAT model. And it was clear from the beginning of the discussion that there are many challenges with that. Principally, one is in the lack of capacity for inpatient treatment beds throughout the county. So we are exploring models that combine day treatment with alcohol and drug-free housing, as well as additional housing. We clearly realized yesterday that we need to have more partners at the table, including parole and probation, the jails, and the DA's office. Key to P57 and VSAT success so far has been to hold offenders accountable and then to get them into the appropriate treatment and housing to break the cycle of addiction and criminality. P57 utilization has been high by the precincts. You should have a snapshot of the last 3 months in front of you, that overall about 90% of those eligible are getting booked by the precincts. And we have allowed some discretion in booking. Officers are required to write a memo when not booked, and the reasons range from people who are injured and aren't able to be booked at that time, to people who want to clear up additional, say, stolen vehicle cases, and we want to drive them around to locations where they stole vehicles from, and we're willing to cite in exchange for recovering a number of stolen vehicles. So we would like to continue that flexibility. So I'll turn over now to Officer Jeff Myers, who I think it's important to get a background of what VSAT is and a little bit of the success and recidivism that we're seeing from the program.
Mayor Potter, Commissioner Sten, Commissioner Leonard, my name is Jeff Myers, and I'm a police officer with Central Precinct Neighborhood Response Team. Approximately 5 years ago, the Police Bureau created a program, the NLCEP, Neighborhood Livability Crime Enforcement Program, and the premise was threefold. One, if we were able to impact offenders immediately, an immediate consequence at the time of the offense, and a short period of detention, 1 to 3 days, which is typical of a booking, and then immediately provide drug and alcohol treatment, mental health treatment, and housing, the third component, our premise was that we would reduce significantly recidivism rates. When we began, we went through the current model, which was community court, who didn't have the resources to provide for the housing and treatment. And we found that our numbers went up. We do data runs based upon 5 downtown neighborhoods, 7 crime classifications to encompass drug and drug-related property crimes for 3-month periods to come up with a group of chronic offenders. And then before we began this, we went we created an outside advisory group, including the demographics of the neighborhoods that we were looking at, African American, Asian, Hispanic, Native American, and Anglo, and we asked the advisory group to look at our methodology in creating a list of chronic offenders to ensure that there was no unintended racial profiling. And they ultimately gave us a 3-page report that supported the fact that we were not. We went forward and we began with this group. We had the ability to, with relationships with the jail, with the county, to book these offenders for any crime. They drop her cigarette butt, we could actually book them, whereas before we didn't have the capacity at the jail to do that. And then we tried to provide them services. Initially, we started working with a mental health director at the county. Just ad hoc, he provided treatment beds and such for us, and we immediately found a 30% drop in recidivism rates. He ultimately left that position, and our numbers went up higher than previous numbers immediately. The city hired through ONI a person to coordinate the efforts we made with the mental health director. And again, through the ad hoc relationships, we were able to reduce those numbers about 30% again. Then the mayor and council began to support monetarily treatment beds and housing. And then immediately we dropped 71%. And we've been able to maintain that reduction in recidivism rates for a 18-month period.
71%.
And to give you some idea, our number one person on the first list had 47 arrests within a 3-month period, did not go to jail for those offenses because they were under the radar for offenses that you could book for and wasn't adjudicated. And there are estimates that it was costing in excess of $1 million a year between county and city services. Individuals in a wheelchair required constant attention at ERs for overdoses, so forth. And now we house him for approximately $60,000 after he's gone through this program and maintain. We still have some jail issues because of behavior, but it's significantly less. Would estimate around $80,000 a year as opposed to the potentially in excess of $1 million that we were previously. And so we've taken a number of people through our program, and certainly it's really, we can show graphically that it's the support from social services, the county, Central City Concern, our partners, Cascadia, all of whom provide the service and treatment. That is paramount in our success in terms of this program.
Well, I've said to many people, I don't know if I've ever said it in this forum before, that the origin of Project 57 came with the walk-along I had with Jeff. And Jeff shared with me his frustrations with those kinds of stats and the lack of resources to actually pinch somebody effectively, put them in jail, get their attention, get them into treatment. So, Jeff, to the extent this is successful, it's due to your great work. You're an outstanding police officer, and I've known a lot of them. And you are just at the top. I really appreciate your approach. You don't just view your job as the role of a police officer enforcing law. You intersect, whether it's we're working on bad buildings to improve, whether we're working on these kinds of things, you just really set the standard. We're really lucky to have you.
Thank you, Commissioner. But really, it is a joint effort. I can't say enough of how much your help and the help of all the partners that we have at the table, the county, the private providers that are providing the resources. Thank you.
So, but one of the questions I did have is I've been told that on any given day of the 57 beds we have, we don't fill them up. I've actually been told up to half of them are allowed to be used by other jurisdictions because we're not filling them up. And so there, as you know, we've been talking back and forth about that, but I'm trying to get a handle on what is it that we need to do to expand the, not expand, I guess, but better utilize all of the available beds that we have on the jail side. And then, of course, that brings up the issue of having to increase our amount of money on the treatment side. But it seems to me we're missing some opportunities to get people in jail beds, which I understand may be wrapped up in the protocol with the courts and that kind of thing. But I think we should understand that, what's causing that to happen.
Well, I think the latest stats show we're filling 53 of those beds.
Oh, wow.
One of the things we've done in the P57 committee that takes a look at it is expand the number of offenses that qualify for P57, which has helped increase utilization. When the program first began, we were trying to be careful about not opening the door too wide. So I think we're learning a lot through that process.
Okay. So we are beginning to approach filling. So do you have the list? Because I saw the list recently of what